Chapter 44. Continued tranquility. Strange assortment of plunder gathered in the cellars and shanties of the rioters. Search for it exasperates the Irish. Noble conduct of the sanitary police. Sergeant Copeland. Prisoners tried. Damages claimed from the city. Number of police killed. 1,200 rioters killed. The Riot Relief Fund. List of colored people killed. Generals Wool and Sanford's reports. Their truthfulness denied. General Brown vindicated. On Saturday morning it was announced that the authorities at Washington had resolved to enforce the draft. It had been repeatedly asserted during the riot that it was abandoned, and the report received very general credence. Still, the official denial of it produced no disturbance. The spirit of insurrection was effectually laid. It is a little singular that, in all these tremendous gatherings and movements, no prominent recognized leaders could be found. A man by the name of Andrews had been arrested and imprisoned as one, but the charge rested wholly on some exciting harangues he had made, not from any active leadership he had assumed. There were, perhaps, in the city this morning not far from 10,000 troops, quite enough to preserve the peace, if the riot should break out afresh, and orders therefore were given to arrest the march of regiments hastening from various sections to the city, under the requisition of the governor. Still, the terror that had taken possession of men could not be allayed in an hour, and although the police had resumed their patrols, and dared to be seen alone in the streets, there was constant dread of personal violence among the citizens. Especially was this true of the Negro population. Although many sought their ruined homes, yet aware of the intense hatred entertained toward them by the mob, they felt unsafe, and began to organize in self-defense. But the day wore away without disturbance, and the Sabbath dawned peaceably, and order reigned from the Battery to Harlem. The military did not show themselves in the street, and thousands thronged without fear the avenues in which the fighting had taken place, to look at the ruins it had left behind. On Monday there was more or less rebellious feeling exhibited by the rioters, on account of the general search of the police for stolen goods, and the arrest of suspected persons. It exhibited itself, however, only in threats and curses. Not a policeman was assaulted. It was amusing, sometimes, to see what strange articles the poor wretches had stowed away in their dirty cellars. There was everything from barrels of sugar and starch to tobacco and birdseed. Set a morning paper colon mahogany and rosewood chairs with brocade upholstering, marble top tables and stands, costly paintings, and hundreds of delicate and valuable mantel ornaments, are daily found in low hovels uptown. Every person in whose possession these articles are discovered disclaims all knowledge of the same, except that they found them in the street, and took them in to prevent them being burned. The entire city will be searched, and it is expected that the greatest portion of the property taken from the buildings sacked by the mob will be recovered. The rivers and outlets to the city were closely watched, to prevent its being carried off. In the meantime, arrests were constantly made. It would be invidious to single out any portion of the police for special commendation, where all did their duty so nobly, but it is not improper to speak of the sanitary police, whose specific duties do not lead them to take part in quelling mobs. They have to report all nuisances, examine tenement houses and unsafe buildings, look after the public schools, but more especially examine steam boilers, and licensed persons qualified to run steam engines. Hence, it is composed of men of considerable scientific knowledge. But all such business being suspended during the riot, they at once, with their captain, B.G. Lord, assumed the duties of the common policeman, and from Monday night till order was restored, were on constant duty, participating in the fights, and enduring the fatigues with unflinching firmness, and did not return to their regular duties till Monday morning. The drill officer also, Sergeant T.S. Copeland, became, instead of a drill officer, a gallant, active leader of his men in some of the most desperate fights that occurred. His military knowledge enabled him to form commands ordered hastily off, with great dispatch. But not content with this, he led them, when formed, to the charge, and gave such lessons in drill, in the midst of the fight, as the police will never forget. With the details of what followed we have nothing to do. The grand jury indicted many of the prisoners, and in the term of the court, that met the 3D of August, 20 were tried and 19 convicted, and sentenced to a longer or shorter term of imprisonment. Of course a large number on preliminary examinations got off, sometimes from want of sufficient evidence, and sometimes from the venality of the judges before whom they were brought. Claims for damages were brought in, the examination of which was long and tedious. The details are published in two large volumes, and the entire cost to the city was probably $3 million. Some of the claims went before the courts, where they lingered along indefinitely. The number of rioters killed or died from the effects of their wounds was put down by the police commissioners at about 1,200. Of course, this estimate is not made up from any detailed reports. The dead and wounded were hurried away, even in the midst of the fight, and hidden in obscure streets, or taken out of the city for fear of future arrests or complications. Hence there was no direct way of getting at the exact number of those who fell victims to the riot. The loss of life, therefore, could only be approximated by taking the regular report of the number of deaths in the city for a few weeks before the riots, and that for the same length of time after. As there was no epidemic, or any report of increased sickness from any disease, the inference naturally was that the excess for the period after the riots was owing to the victims of them. Many of these were reported as sunstrokes, owing to men exposing themselves to the sun with pounded and battered heads. The police commissioners took great care to keep all the wounded policemen indoors until perfectly cured. Only one ventured to neglect their orders, and he died of a sunstroke. The difference of mortality in the city for the month previous to the riots, and the month during and subsequent, was about 1,200, which excess Mr. Acton thought should be put down to the deaths caused directly and indirectly by the riots. Although many policemen were wounded, only 3 were killed or died from the injuries they received. Immediately after the riot, Mr. Leonard W. Jerome and others interested themselves in raising a fund for the relief of members of the police, militia, and fire departments who had sustained injuries in the discharge of their duty in suppressing the riots. Subscriptions to the amount of $54,980 were paid in, and $22,721.553 distributed by the trustees of the Riot Relief Fund, in sums from $50 to $1,000 each, through Isaac Bell, treasurer, to 101 policemen, 16 militiamen, and 7 firemen. The balance was securely invested to meet future emergencies, a portion of which was paid to sufferers by the Orange Riot of 1871. The following is the list of colored people known to be killed by the mob, together with the circumstances attending their murder, as given by David Barnes in his Metropolitan Record, to which reference has heretofore been made. Colored victims of the riot. William Henry Nichols, colored. Nichols resided at number 147 East 28th Street. Mrs. Stott, his mother, was visiting him. On Wednesday, July 15, at 3 o'clock, the house was attacked by a mob with showers of bricks and stones. In one of the rooms was a woman with a child, but 3 days old. The rioters broke open the door with axes and rushed in. Nichols and his mother fled to the basement. In a few moments the babe referred to was dashed by the rioters from the upper window to the yard, and instantly killed. The mob cut the water pipes above, and the basement was being deluged. 10 persons, mostly women and children, were there, and they fled to the yard. In attempting to climb the fence, Mrs. Stott fell back from exhaustion. The rioters were instantly upon her. her son sprang to her rescue, exclaiming, "Save my mother, if you kill me." Two ruffians instantly seized him, each taking hold of an arm, while a third, armed with a crowbar, calling upon them to hold his arms apart, deliberately struck him a savage blow on the head, felling him like a bullock. He died in the NY hospital 2 days after. James Costello, colored. James Costello, number 97 West 33rd Street, killed on Tuesday morning, July 14. Costello was a shoemaker, an active man in his business, industrious and sober. He went out early in the morning upon an errand, was accosted, and finally was pursued by a powerful man. He ran down the street, endeavored to make his escape, was nearly overtaken by his pursuer. In self-defense he turned and shot the rioter with a revolver. The shot proved to be mortal. He died 2 days after. Costello was immediately set upon by the mob. They first mangled his body, then hanged it. They then cut down his body, and dragged it through the gutters, smashing it with stones, and finally burned it. The mob then attempted to kill Mrs. Costello and her children, but she escaped by climbing fences and taking refuge in a police station house. Abraham Franklin, colored. This young man, who was murdered by the mob on the corner of 27th Street and 7th Avenue, was a quiet, inoffensive man, of unexceptionable character. He was a cripple, but supported himself and his mother, being employed as a coachman. A short time previous to the assault, he called upon his mother to see if anything could be done by him for her safety. The old lady said she considered herself perfectly safe, but if her time to die had come, she was ready to die. Her son then knelt down by her side and implored the protection of heaven in behalf of his mother. The old lady said that it seemed to her that good angels were present in the room. Scarcely had the supplicant risen from his knees when the mob broke down the door, seized him, beat him over the head and face with fists and clubs, and then hanged him in the presence of his parent. While they were thus engaged, the military came and drove them away, cutting down the body of Franklin, who raised his arm once slightly and gave a few signs of life. The military then moved on to quell other riots, when the mob returned and again suspended the now probably lifeless body of Franklin, cutting out pieces of flesh, and otherwise shockingly mutilating it. Augustus Stewart, colored, died at hospital, Blackwell's Island, July 22, from the effects of a blow received at the hands of the mob, on Wednesday evening of the riot week. He had been badly beaten previously by a band of rioters, and was frightened and insane from the effects of the blows which he had received. He was running toward the Arsenal State, 7th Avenue and 37th Street, for safety, when he was overtaken by the mob, from whom he received his death blow. Peter Houston. Peter Houston, 63 years of age, a Mohawk Indian, dark complexion, but straight hair, and for several years a resident of New York, proved a victim to the riots. Houston served with the New York Volunteers in the Mexican War. He was brutally attacked and shockingly beaten, on the 13th of July, by a gang of ruffians, who thought him to be of the African race, because of his dark complexion. He died within 4 days, at Bellevue Hospital, from his injuries. Jeremiah Robinson, colored. He was killed in Madison near Catherine Street. His widow stated that her husband, in order to escape, dressed himself in some of her clothes, and, in company with herself and one other woman, left their residence, and went toward one of the Brooklyn ferries. Robinson wore a hood, which failed to hide his beard. Some boys, seeing his beard, lifted up the skirts of his dress, which exposed his heavy boots. Immediately the mob set upon him, and the atrocities they perpetrated are so revolting that they are unfit for publication. They finally killed him and threw his body into the river. His wife and her companion ran up Madison Street and escaped across the Grand Street Ferry to Brooklyn. William Jones, colored. A crowd of rioters in Clarkson Street, in pursuit of a Negro, who in self-defense had fired on some rowdies, met an inoffensive colored man returning from a bakery with a loaf of bread under his arm. They instantly set upon and beat him, and, after nearly killing him, hung him to a lamppost. His body was left suspended for several hours. A fire was made underneath him, and he was literally roasted as he hung, the mob reveling in their demoniac act. Recognition of the remains, on their being recovered, was impossible, and two women mourned for upwards of 2 weeks, in the case of this man, for the loss of their husbands. At the end of that time, the husband of one of the mourners, to her great joy, returned like one recovered from the grave. The principal evidence which the widow, Mary Jones, had to identify the murdered man as her husband, was the fact of his having a loaf of bread under his arm, he having left the house, to get a loaf of bread a few minutes before the attack. Joseph Reed, colored. This was a lad of 7 years of age, residing at number 147 East 28th Street, with an aged grandmother and widowed mother. On Wednesday morning of the fearful week, a crowd of ruffians gathered in the neighborhood, determined on a week of plunder and death. They attacked the house, stole everything they could carry with them, and, after threatening the inmates, set fire to it. The colored people who had the sole occupancy of the building, fled in confusion into the midst of the gathering crowd. And then the child was separated from his guardians. His youth and evident illness, even from the devils around him, it would be thought, should have ensured his safety. But no sooner did they see his unprotected, defenseless condition, than a gang of fiendish men seized him, beat him with sticks, and bruised him with heavy cobblestones. But one, tenfold more the servant of Satan than the rest, rushed at the child, and with the stock of a pistol, struck him on the temple, and felled him to the ground. A noble young fireman, by the name of John F. Govern, of No. 39 Hose Company, instantly came to the rescue, and, single-handed, held the crowd at bay. Taking the wounded, and unconscious boy in his arms, he carried him to a place of safety. The terrible beating, and the great fright the poor lad had undergone was too much for his feeble frame. He died on the following Tuesday. Joseph Jackson, colored, aged 19 years, living in West 53rd Street, near 6th Avenue, was in the industrious pursuit of his humble occupation of gathering provender for a herd of cattle, and when near the foot of 34th Street, East River, July 15, was set upon by the mob. Killed, and his body thrown into the river. Samuel Johnson, colored. On Tuesday night Johnson was attacked near Fulton Ferry by a gang who mercilessly beat and left him for dead. A proposition was made to throw him into the river, but for some reason the murderers took fright and fled. He was taken by some citizens to his home, and died the next day. Williams, colored. He was attacked on the corner of Leroy and Washington Streets, on Tuesday morning, July 14, knocked down, a number of men jumped upon, kicked, and stamped upon him until insensible. One of the murderers knelt on the body, and drove a knife into it, the blade being too small, he threw it away, and resorted to his fists. Another seized a huge stone, weighing near 20 pounds, and deliberately crushed it again and again onto the victim. A force of police, under Captain Dixon, arrived and rescued the man, who was conveyed to the New York hospital. He was only able to articulate Williams in response to a question as to his name, and remained insensible thereafter, dying in a few days. Ann Erickson. This was a white woman, the wife of a colored man, and lived at No. 11 York Street. On Wednesday, July 15, the rioters seized the son of deceased, a lad of about 12 years, saturated his clothes and hair with camphor, and then procuring a rope, fastened one end to a lamp post, the other around his neck, and were about to set him on fire, and hang him. They were interfered with by some citizens, and by the police of the First Ward, and their diabolical attempt at murder frustrated. While Mrs. Derrickson was attempting to save the life of her son, she was horribly bruised and beaten with a cart rung. The victim, after lingering 3 or 4 weeks, died from the effects of her injuries. Reports from the captains of the several precincts, with all the details of their operations, were made out also from the subordinate military officers to their immediate superiors. The final reports of General Wool, commanding the Eastern Department, and Major General Sanford, commanding the city troops, caused much remark in the city papers, and called forth a reply from General Brown, who considered himself unjustly assailed in them. Explanation of the disagreement between him and General Wool having been fully given, it is not necessary to repeat it here. The same may be said of the statement of General Wool regarding his orders on Monday the 13th, respecting the troops in the harbor. But in this report of General Wool to Governor Seymour, there are other statements which General Brown felt it his duty to correct. General Wool says that finding there was a want of harmony between General Sanford and Brown in the disposition of troops, he issued the following order: Major General Sanford, Brevet Brigadier General Brown. Gentlemen, it is indispensable to collect your troops not stationed, and of them divided into suitable parties, with a due proportion of police to each, and to patrol in such parts of the city as may be in the greatest danger from the rioters. This ought to be done as soon as practicable. John E. Wool, Major General. After this had been issued, General Sanford reporting to me that his orders were not obeyed by General Brown, I issued the following order: All the troops called out for the protection of the city are placed under the command of General Sanford. General Brown in his reply says that he never saw or heard of this first order. The only explanation of this, consistent with the character of both, is that General Wool sent this order to General Sanford alone, either forgetting to transmit it to General Brown, or expecting General Sanford to do it. At all events, sent or not, it was a foolish order. One would infer from it that the whole task of putting down the riots belonged to the military, the commanders of which were to order out what cooperating force of police they deemed necessary, and march up and down the disaffected districts, trampling out the lawlessness according to rule. This might be all well enough, but the question was, how were these troops, strangers to the city, to find out where such parts of the city were in which was the greatest danger from the rioters? It showed a lamentable ignorance of mobs. They don't stay in one spot and fight it out, nor keep in one mass, nor give notice beforehand where they will strike next. Such knowledge could only be obtained from police headquarters, the focus of the telegraph system, and there the troops should have been ordered to concentrate at once, and put themselves under the direction of the police commissioners. Again, General Wool says he issued the following order to General Brown on Tuesday: Sir, it is reported that the rioters have already recommenced their work of destruction. Today there must be no child's play. Some of the troops under your command should be sent immediately to attack and stop those who have commenced their infernal rascality in Yorkville and Harlem. This order, too, General Brown says he never received. Thinking it strange, he addressed a note to General Wool's assistant adjutant general, respecting both these orders, which had thus strangely wandered out of the way. The latter, Major Christensen, replied as follows: The orders of General Wool published in his report to Governor Seymour, viz. That patrols of military and police should be sent through the disaffected districts, and the one July 14th, today there must be no child's play, etc., were not issued by me, and I cannot therefore say whether copies were sent to you or not. They were certainly not sent by me. C. F.F. Christensen, Major, Assistant Adjutant General. We have explained how the error may have occurred with regard to the first order. But there is no explanation of this, except on the ground that General Wool perhaps sketched out this order without sending it, and afterwards seeing it amid his papers, thought it was a copy of one he had sent. He was well advanced in years, and might easily fall into some such error. It is not necessary to go into detailed account of all the statements contained in General Wool's letter which General Brown emphatically denies, but the following is worthy of notice. He says that General Brown issued orders that General Sanford countermanded, and that General Brown acted through the riots under his, Wool's, orders, whereas the latter says, he never received, but three orders from Wool during the whole time, and only one of those referred to any action towards the rioters, and that was to bring off some killed and wounded men left by a military force sent out either by Sanford or Wool, and which had been chased from the field by the mob. But the statements of General Wool are entirely thrown into the shade by the following assertion of General Sanford, in his report. He says, with the remnant of the his division left in the city, and the first reinforcements from General Wool, detachments were sent to all parts of the city, and the rioters everywhere beaten and dispersed on Monday afternoon, Monday night, and Tuesday morning. In a few hours, but for the interference of Brigadier General Brown, who, in disobedience of orders, etc., the perfect gravity with which this assertion is made is something marvelous. One would infer that the police was of no account, except to maintain order after it was fully restored by the military on Tuesday morning. General Sanford might well be ignorant of the state of things in the city, for he was cooped up in the arsenal, intent only on holding his fortress. So far as he was concerned, the whole city might have been burned up before Tuesday noon, and he would scarcely have known it, except as he saw the smoke and flames from the roof of the arsenal. He never sent out a detachment until after the Tuesday afternoon, when, as he says, but for General Brown's action, the riot would have been virtually over. The simple truth is, these reports of Generals Wool and Sanford are both mere afterthoughts, growing out of the annoyance they felt on knowing that their martinetism was a total failure, and the whole work had been done by General Brown and the police commissioners from their headquarters in Mulberry Street. Acton and Brown had no time to grumble or dispute about etiquette. They had something more serious on hand, and they bent their entire energies to their accomplishment. General Sanford held the arsenal, an important point, indeed a vital one, and let him claim and receive all the credit to that achievement. But to assume any special merit in quelling the riots in the streets is simply ridiculous. That was the work of the police and the military under the commissioners and General Brown. The statement of the police commissioners, Acton and Bergen, on this point is conclusive. They say that General Sanford's error consisted in choosing to be in close communication with this department when alone through the police telegraph and other certain means, trustworthy information of the movements of the mob could be promptly had. That single statement is enough to overthrow all of General Sanford's assertions about the riot. It was hardly necessary for them to declare further in their letter to General Brown. So far from your action having had the effects opposed by General Sanford, we are of the opinion, already expressed in our address to the police force, that through your prompt, vigorous, and intelligent action, the intrepidity and steady valor of the small military force under you, acting with the police force, the riotous proceedings were arrested on Thursday night, and that without such aid mob violence would have continued much longer. Well-earned praise. On the week after the riot, the Board of Police Commissioners issued the following address to the force, in which a well-earned tribute is paid to the military. To the Metropolitan Police Force. On the morning of Monday, the 13th inst., the peace and good order of the city were broken by a mob collected in several quarters of the city for the avowed purpose of resisting the process of drafting names to recruit the armies of the Union. Vast crowds of men collected and fired the offices where drafting was in progress, beating and driving the officers from duty. From the beginning, these violent proceedings were accompanied by arson, robbery, and murder. Private property, unofficial persons of all ages, sexes, and conditions, were indiscriminately assailed. None were spared, except those who were supposed by the mob to sympathize with their proceedings. Early in the day, the superintendent was assaulted, cruelly beaten, robbed, and disabled by the mob, which was engaged in burning the provost marshal's office in 3rd Avenue, thus in a manner disarranging the organization at the central department, throwing new, unwanted, and responsible duties upon the board. At this juncture, the telegraph wires of the department were cut, and the movement of the railroads and stages violently interrupted, interfering seriously with our accustomed means of transmitting orders and concentrating forces. The militia of the city were absent at the seat of war, fighting the battles of the nation against treason and secession, and there was no adequate force in the city for the first 12 hours to resist at all points the vast and infuriated mob. The police force was not strong enough in any precinct to make head, unaided, against the overwhelming force. No course was left but to concentrate the whole force at the central department, and thence send detachments able to encounter and conquer the rioters. This course was promptly adopted on Monday morning. The military were called upon to act in aid of the civil force, to subdue the treasonable mob, protect life and property, and restore public order. Under such adverse circumstances, you were called upon to encounter a mob of such strength as have never before been seen in this country. The force of militia under General Sanford, who were called into service by the authority of this board, were concentrated by him at and held the arsenal in 7th Avenue throughout the contest. The military forces in command of Brevet Brigadier General Harvey Brown reported at the Central Department, and there General Brown established his headquarters, and from their expeditions, combined of police and military force, were sent out that in all cases conquered, defeated, or dispersed the mob force, and subjected them to severe chastisement. In no instance did these detachments from the central department, whether of police alone, or police and military combined, meet with defeat or serious check. In all cases they achieved prompt and decisive victories. The contest continued through Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and till 11 o'clock on Thursday night, like a continuous battle, when it ended by a total and sanguinary rout of the insurgents. During the whole of those anxious days and nights, Brigadier General Brown remained at the Central Department, ordering the movements of the military in carefully considered combinations with the police force, and throughout the struggle, and until its close, commanded the admiration and gratitude of the police department, and all who witnessed his firm intelligence and soldierly conduct. It is understood that he had at no time under his immediate command more than 300 troops, but they were of the highest order, and were commanded by officers of courage and ability. They cordially acted with, supported, and were supported by, the police, and victory in every contest against fearful odds was the result of brave fighting and intelligent command. In the judgment of this board, the escape of the city from the power of an infuriated mob is due to the aid furnished the police by Brigadier General Brown and the small military force under his command. No one can doubt, who saw him, as we did, that during those anxious and eventful days and nights, Brigadier General Harvey Brown was equal to the situation and was the right man in the right place. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.